Lawrence was the first good-sized settlement they came to. It had been raided twice by Jayhawkers, first before the Civil War, and then during the war by William Quantrill's marauders, who had burned the town to the ground. Lawrence had rebuilt and was now a peaceful farming community, with few, if any, reminders of the bloody violence that had taken place there. They spent 2 days camped outside town while the kid and Arturo asked questions of the settlers. Nobody seemed to know anything about Pamela. Nobody tried to kill the kid either, which told him she probably hadn't disembarked the train there. It was a good break for Arturo, too, since he wasn't used to sitting on the hard, bouncing seat of a buckboard all day long. His skin was already starting to tan, and he was handling the four-horse team with more confidence. They moved on to Topeka. For a capital city, the settlement was on the smallish size, but still large enough that the kid and Arturo spent a week there, poking around and asking questions. The kid wired Charles Harcourt to find out if there had been any new developments in Boston, but Harcourt reported that he and Jack Mallory had been unsuccessful in their efforts to uncover any more facets of Pamela's far-reaching plot. After a week, the kid thought it was time they moved on. He began to have the feeling that Pamela wouldn't have hidden the children in a large town or city where he wouldn't have any realistic chance of finding them. She hadn't wanted that. She'd wanted him to stay on the trail, and he wouldn't do that if the chances of finding the twins were so small as to be hopeless. She'd wanted him to keep going, so he could keep stepping right into the traps she had prepared for him. The kid was convinced it was much more likely the children were hidden away in some small settlement along the rail line, and that was where he and Arturo would devote their efforts. Abilene was still famous for everything that had happened during its days as a wild, hell-roaring cow town. The sleepy little farming community bore little resemblance to that bloody hell on wheels where Wild Bill Hickok had ruled as city marshal. It was just the sort of place where Pamela might have stashed the twins, the kid thought, as he and Arturo rolled across the bridge over Mud Creek and down Front Street. Dusk was settling over the town. The kid turned in the saddle and pointed toward a two-story brick hotel.
We'll stay there tonight. Be nice to sleep in a real bed, won't it?
Oh, I don't know. I'm getting used to being uncomfortable. How will I know what to do if there aren't insects biting me and rocks jabbing me all night?
You'll figure it out. Here's a livery stable.
The kid swung down from the saddle and led the black and the pack mule through the open double doors into the barn. Arturo brought the buckboard to a halt just outside. An elderly hostler, quite spry despite his age, greeted them.
You gents want to put them animals up for the night?
The kid nodded.
Then I reckon we can park the buckboard out back?
Sure, sure. No charge for that. 2 bits a night for the critters, though.
Fair enough.
The kid took a $5 gold piece from his pocket and handed it to the old man.
That'll cover 3 nights with a little left over. Give them a little extra grain. They deserve it.
I sure will. You fellas been traveling a far piece?
Far enough. Have you been around these parts for long?
Aw, shoot, yeah. 20 years or more. Name's Barlow.
Morgan. My friend's Vincent.
Pleased to meet you both.
We're looking for some old friends of ours. You might remember if they've been here.
I see most everybody who comes through town, except for the folks who never get off the train when it stops.
This lady would have come in on the train. A very beautiful lady with 2 young children, traveling with a friend of hers. She brought the children out to let them stay for a spell with either some relatives or friends of hers. I'm not sure which.
The kid had devoted considerable thought to the matter and figured that was the story Pamela might have used. The sudden, unexplained presence of 2 new children in a family might draw too much attention, but people took in youngsters belonging to friends or relatives all the time, when there was some sort of hardship or other circumstance that warranted it. Pamela would have made it worth the trouble to any family where she left the twins to spread that lie.
Hey, that don't sound familiar. About how long ago are we talking about, Mr. Morgan?
3 years or so. Maybe not quite that long.
3 years, huh? That's a long spell, especially to a fella like me who's getting older and don't remember so good anymore.
Would a double eagle improve your memory?
What? Oh, no, no, I'm telling the truth, not hinting for more money. I've been right on the straight and narrow ever since me and my brothers got in some trouble with the law years back. I really don't remember so good no more, Mr. Morgan. But I'm thinking I never heard tell about no lady bringing some kids here like that and leaving them.
Well, if anything comes to you, my friend and I'll be staying over at the hotel for a day or two. Let us know, will you?
I sure will.
Barlow's eyes widened as a thought occurred to him.
Say, I know who you ought to talk to. Marshal Fisher. He's been around Abilene even longer than I have.
The kid had been trying not to involve the law in his search, but he thought maybe the suggestion was a good one.
I'll do that. We'll get these horses unhitched and unsaddled.
Hey, let me do that. I got to earn my keep. I've been an honest businessman for a long time now. You get whatever you want to take to the hotel with you, and I'll lock up your saddle and the rest of your gear in the tack room.
Much obliged.
The kid slid his Winchester from the sheath, strapped to the black's saddle, and draped the pair of saddlebags over his shoulder. Arturo took a pair of small valises from the back of the buckboard.
Well, he was quite a colorful character.
I'm sure he'd think the same thing about you.
In the fading light, the kid spotted a squarish, solid-looking building made of stone, up ahead on the left across the street. An oil lamp burned in front of the building, and the windows glowed yellow with lamplight. A sign attached to the wall beside the door read, Marshal's Office. The lawman appeared to be in his office.
Why don't you go on to the hotel and get a couple of rooms for us? I think I'll stop and talk to the Marshal, like Mr. Barlow suggested.
And do you think he'll be willing to help you?
I don't know, but Barlow said that he'd been around Abilene for a long time. He's been packing a badge all that time. He's probably kept a pretty close eye on the comings and goings in town. He might be more likely to remember seeing Pamela than anybody else.
Strikes me as a reasonable assumption. Good luck.
Thanks.
The kid started to step down from the boardwalk so he could angle across the street to the Marshal's office.
Get us rooms in the back, if you can. Quieter that way.
Of course.
Arturo continued on his way, and the kid stepped into the broad, dusty street. He was only partway across when he heard the sudden rataplan of hoofbeats. Stopping, he saw a group of riders coming quickly toward him. The red glow from the setting sun in the sky behind them cast them in stark silhouette. Four men on horseback, and they didn't seem inclined to slow down or go around him. With his mouth tightening in anger, the kid took a fast step back to avoid being trampled. Once the horsemen were past him, he started toward the marshal's office again. The kid slowed as he saw the riders pull their mounts to a stop in front of the stone building. They swung down, stepped onto the boardwalk, and then paused for a second. Even in the fading light, the kid's keen eyes saw the men reach down and check to make sure their guns were loose in their holsters. That was a sure sign trouble was brewing, the kid thought, as one of the men jerked open the door and all four of them marched into the marshal's office. Whatever was about to happen, it was none of his business, he told himself. He didn't know who those four men were, and he'd never even heard of Abilene's Marshal Fisher until a few minutes earlier. The smart thing to do would be to turn around, follow Arturo to the hotel, and come back to see the marshal later. But suppose there was trouble, and Fisher got himself shot full of holes. He might know something about Pamela and the children, but a dead man was no use to Kid Morgan. He still had the Winchester in his hands, and he worked the lever to throw around into the rifle's chamber. The four men had left the door partially open. As he stepped onto the boardwalk, the kid heard a harsh voice.
You let him out there, Marshal, or five guys will take him out. You won't like what happens if you have to do that.
It was enough to give the kid a pretty good idea of what was going on. Using the Winchester's barrel to push the door open the rest of the way, he stepped into the doorway.
And I don't reckon you boys will like what happens if you try.
In a matter of seconds, the kid's eyes took in the scene in the marshal's office. The four who had just entered had arranged themselves in a threatening half-circle around a man who stood with his back to the thick wooden door that separated the office from the cell block in the rear of the building. The man was in his 40s, slender as a whip, with graying fair hair and a mustache. He was dressed all in black and had a holstered Colt on his hip, along with a marshal's badge pinned to his leather vest. The oldest of the four intruders was older than the marshal, with a derby hat on thinning red hair and a grizzled beard of the same shade sprouting from his jaw. The youngest was no more than 20. Curly brown hair fell around his shoulders. Despite his youth, the eyes he turned toward the kid were flat and devoid of humanity, like the eyes of a snake. The other two were in their 30s, typical hard cases in worn range clothes. One of them, who had a prominent beak of a nose over a thick, drooping black mustache, glared at the kid.
Who the hell are you?
This ain't none of your business, mister. You best skedaddle.
My business is with the marshal, so you'd best conclude whatever brought you here and then leave so I can get on with it.
You're making a bad mistake. Haul your freight out of here.
Yeah! You don't want to get on our bad side, mister. We work for Cordellum.
Never heard of him.
Big Nose ignored him and looked back at the marshal.
How about it, Fisher? You gonna let Barnes out?
Not hardly. We don't know yet if that girl's going to live or not. And even if she does, Barnes will have to answer for what he did to her.
Court's not gonna like this. He wants his men treated with respect.
I don't give a damn what Elam likes or don't like. As far as I'm concerned, none of you varmints have earned a lick of respect from me or anybody else in Abilene. Why don't you just ride on back to Powderhorn?
We can take him, Jim. There's four of us, and only two of them.
Yeah, but one of them is behind us with a Winchester. We'll go, Fisher. But this ain't over.
Yeah, you'll be seeing us again.
More than likely over the barrel of a gun.
The kid's instinctive liking for him increased. The kid moved aside from the door to let the four hard cases file out of the office. He kept them covered the whole time. When they were gone, he towed the door shut and lowered the rifle as he turned toward the marshal.
Get out!
The kid leaped toward the desk where a lamp was burning. Even as he blew out the flame, both of the windows in the office exploded inward under the onslaught of a volley of shots fired from outside. The kid had halfway expected something like that, so he was already diving toward the floor as shards of broken glass sprayed around him. He had an arm over his face to protect his eyes. He rolled over as he landed and came up on one knee, still holding the Winchester. He thrust the rifle through the busted window closest to him and aimed at the muzzle flashes in the street, cranking off three rounds as fast as he could work the lever. Marshal Fisher had snatched a loaded rifle from the rack on the wall behind the desk and crouched at the other window to open fire. He and the kid raked the street with their shots, and that was enough to make the four mounted men dig in their spurs and send their horses lunging away from the marshal's office.
Hold your fire! They're leaving. Don't want any stray bullets hitting anybody else.
The kid pulled the Winchester back from the window. The rifle was chambered to use the same rounds as his Colt, so he took fresh cartridges from the loops on his shell belt and thumbed them through the Winchester's loading gate, working in the dark with the ease of long familiarity.
You hit? I picked up a scratch or two when those windows broke, but that's all. How about you?
Not even a scratch. There's shutters on the windows. Let's close them before I strike a light again.
That sounded like a good idea to the kid. He closed and latched the shutters on the window where he had been firing at the gunman, and heard the marshal doing the same at the other window. The scratch of a lucifer came a moment later. Light flared up from the match. Fisher lit the lamp. In its glow, the kid studied the shutters, which had a double layer of thick boards that would stop most rifle bullets and anything smaller than that. The office door was formidable, too. With the building's stone walls, it would take a cannon to bust in there.
Stranger in Abilene, aren't you?
That's right. A friend and I just rode in a little while ago.
That was good timing as far as I'm concerned. I'm obliged to you for your help, Mr.
Morgan.
Morgan. You said you had some business with me?
The kid tucked his Winchester under his arm.
We stopped at the livery stable down the street, and the old-timer running it said you'd been a lawman here in Abilene for quite a while.
About 20 years. Started out as a deputy under Marshal Travis. Took on the top job when he retired.
Then you've probably seen most people who have come and gone during that time.
Most of them, I guess.
Fisher gave the kid a shrewd look.
I take it you're looking for somebody in particular.
A woman.
Fisher held up a hand to stop him.
Wait a minute. Stories that start out with a fella looking for a woman generally take some time and require a cup of coffee.
Don't mind if I do.
Fisher filled 10 cups and nodded the kid into a chair in front of the desk. The lawman took a seat behind the desk and propped a booted foot on its corner.
Go ahead.
This woman would have come into Abilene on the train.
The kid described Pamela, not downplaying her beauty. It was a shame that such a lovely exterior had concealed such an evil soul, but that's how it was.
She would have been traveling with another woman, I don't know much about her, and a couple of kids a few months old, a boy and a girl.
I don't recall anybody like that moving to Abilene recently.
It would have been about 3 years ago, and the woman wouldn't have stayed here. Maybe the other woman did, I don't know, but she might have left the children.
Huh. Abandoned them, you mean?
No, she would have found somebody to take them in. She probably would have paid them to spread the story that the kids belonged to some relative of theirs.
I don't know absolutely everybody in Abilene, Mr. Morgan, but I can promise you I never heard tell anything like that happen around here, certainly not in the past 3 years. Anybody who's gotten any kids has had them show up in the, normal way.
The kid's instincts told him Fisher wasn't lying, hadn't been paid off by Pamela to lie. For one thing, that would have required a certain degree of crookedness on the marshal's part, and the kid had a hunch Fisher was as straight arrow a lawman as anybody would ever find.
Well, I can't say as I'm surprised.
Who is this woman you're looking for, Morgan? If she's not wanted by the law, I suppose you can tell me it's none of my business, but...
She's not wanted. She's dead. Has been for more than a year.
Was she the mother of those kids?
That's right.
And you're the father.
I didn't even know about them until a long time after she'd taken them and hidden them away somewhere.
Fisher took his foot off the desk and sat up straight in his chair.
That's a damned rough thing for a man to have happen. I wish I could help you, but I can pretty much guarantee the children aren't here in Abilene. Tell you what I'll do, though. If you're looking to be around here for a day or two, I'll put out the word, just in case I've overlooked something.
I'd appreciate that, Marshal.
If you don't mind indulging my curiosity, how do you know she hid him somewhere?
I got a letter from her after she died. She had left it with a relative of hers, along with instructions that I was to get it after a certain amount of time had passed.
That's a pretty damned low thing to do.
Yeah, it sure is. Now indulge my curiosity, if you would, Marshal. Who were those men, and what did they want?
Hired guns who worked for a man named Court Elam. I've got another of Elam's men locked up back there. He was drunk and got too rough with a soiled dove. Slapped her around till she passed out, and she hadn't regained consciousness. That was 2 nights ago, so it doesn't look very good for her. I figure the varmint will hang for murder before it's all over.
And Elam doesn't like that, does he?
Not one damned bit. He's the big skookum he-wolf of a town called Powderhorn, about 30 miles west of here. He and his gunnies have everybody there buffaloed, and he don't like it when anybody challenges him. He seems to think he ought to run things in this whole part of the state and can get away with whatever he or his men want to do.
But you don't agree with that?
Inside the town limits of Abilene, I sure don't.
Well, Marshal, I wish you the best of luck with this problem.
The Marshal regarded him through narrowed eyes.
You wouldn't be interested in pinning on a deputy's badge, would you? Just temporary-like, till I see what's going to happen.
Sorry, I'm not a lawman.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid you'd say. And you've got those kids to look for, too. I can't blame you for thinking that's more important.
A look of surprise came over Fisher's lean face as something occurred to him.
Say, I just thought of something that might help you. There's an orphanage not far from here. What better place to hide a couple of kids than someplace where there's a whole passel of them to start with?
You're right. All Pamela would have had to do was claim they were orphans and leave them there.
Yeah, you want to check that out for sure.
Where is this orphanage?
Well, that might be a little problem for you. You see, it's in Powderhorn. And after tonight, I don't think Elam's gunwolves are going to be too happy to see you again.
By the time the kid reached the hotel, Arturo had rented 2 rooms for them. They were on the 2nd floor, in the back, as the kid had requested, and were next to each other. Arturo had taken the valises upstairs and placed one in each room. He was waiting in an armchair in the lobby when the kid came in.
I heard a considerable amount of shooting a short time ago. I suppose it's too much to hope for that you were not involved in that, kid.
I had a hand in it.
I suspected as much.
Arturo frowned as he spotted a bit of dried blood on the kid's face where a piece of the flying glass had cut him.
Good Lord, you are wounded. Do you require medical attention?
I'm fine. Just a tiny scratch. Don't worry about me, Arturo.
It is my job to worry. But did you get a chance to talk to the Marshal? Or were you set upon by crazed gunmen before you reached his office?
I talked to him. He doesn't remember anyone like Pamela ever stopping here. And he's convinced that no children have shown up mysteriously in Abilene in the past 3 years. But he's going to investigate, just to be sure.
Why would he do that?
Because I pitched in and gave him a hand when some hired guns tried to bust a friend of theirs out of jail.
Ah, the light dawns. Those were the shots I heard.
That's right.
Was anyone killed?
Not this time.
In a low voice, the kid quickly filled him in on what had happened at Marshal Fisher's office. When the kid was finished, Arturo frowned in thought.
Wait just a moment. You said that no one was killed this time. Do you plan to have another violent encounter with these men?
I'm not planning on it, but it could happen. You see, they're from a place called Powderhorn, and that's where we're going from here. Come on, I'll tell you all about it.
They went up to the kid's room, where the kid told Arturo about the orphanage in the settlement called Powderhorn.
Marshal Fisher didn't know much about the place, only that it's been here for about 5 years and is run by an old widow named Shanley. He said he couldn't think of a better place to hide a couple of kids than an orphanage, and I agree with him.
It certainly seems feasible to me, sir. All Miss Tarleton would have had to do was claim that the parents of the children were dead. I doubt if this Mrs. Shanley would have demanded any proof, because, after all...
Who would lie about such a thing?
Exactly. I believe this may be the most promising development in our search so far.
I agree. We'll stay here tonight and start for Powderhorn tomorrow.
Where there may well be men who are, what is the expression? Gunning for you?
We ought to be used to that by now.
They didn't leave Abilene until almost noon the next day. The kid considered it unlikely the former Cowtown held anything else that would help him in his quest, but he had agreed to let Marshal Fisher ask some questions around the settlement. The kid was confident if anyone could get answers, it was Fisher. The lawman came to the hotel late in the morning and knocked on the kid's door. Arturo was waiting there, too. The buckboard was ready to roll down at Barlow's livery stable, and the kid's black gelding was saddled. Fisher came in and gave both men a curt nod.
I didn't turn up anything about the woman and the children you're looking for, Morgan. Like I told you last night, I don't think they were ever here, except to pass through on the train.
Thanks anyway, Marshal. I appreciate you looking into it.
If you want, I could ride over to Powderhorn with you. I'd be out of my jurisdiction over there, so I wouldn't have any legal standing, but I might be able to lend you a hand.
I appreciate the offer, but you have enough on your plate right here. How's that injured woman doing, by the way?
She died early this morning. Elam's man will be charged with murder. I don't doubt that he'll wind up dancing at the end of a hang rope.
Sounds like the best place for him.
I already wired the sheriff over in the county seat. He's on his way here with some deputies to pick up the prisoner. I'll have Barnes off my hands before the end of the day, and that's just fine with me.
Maybe we should stay here to lend you a hand in case you need it.
You mean if all of Elam's men ride back here to bust him out? It was different while the girl was still alive. Elam was willing to risk trying to get him out then. Now it's murder. He won't try it. He's got a thin shred of respectability left in Powderhorn, and he'd like to hang on to it. He won't risk turning outlaw all the way for scum like Barnes.
You're sure of that?
Sure enough. I'll say one thing, though. Court Elam's going to be in a mighty bad mood by the time you and your friend get to Powderhorn.
We'll have to risk it. Maybe we won't have any run-ins with his men. We're just going to Mrs. Shanley's orphanage. No reason for us to get involved in anything else.
Hope it works out for you. Good luck.
Less than 10 minutes later, the kid rode out of Abilene, leading the pack mule, with Arturo following in the buckboard. The main trail was easy to follow. Even if it hadn't been, the railroad tracks lay a couple of 100 yards to the south, with the telegraph poles running along beside them. They probably wouldn't be able to cover the whole 30 miles to Powderhorn in one day, the kid knew, but they would put enough distance behind them that they could reach the settlement the next day without any trouble. Arturo had packed a lunch from a place back in Abilene called the Sunrise Cafe. They stopped to eat and rest the horses early in the afternoon, when they were only a few miles from town, then resumed the trip. A short time later, the kid spotted some dust ahead of them. A cloud of it boiled up and moved toward them.
Riders coming, and they're in a hurry.
The kid held up his hand in a signal to stop.
Must be half a dozen or more horses to be kicking up that much dust.
Who do you think they are, and why are they in such a hurry?
I'm not sure, but let's get off the trail.
The kid pointed to a clump of scrubby cottonwood trees about 100 yards to the north. Arturo turned the team and got the buckboard rolling in that direction. The kid hung back and watched the dust approach. When he could see some black shapes at the base of the cloud, he turned the black and galloped over to the trees. The cottonwoods didn't provide all that much cover. If the riders had been paying any attention, they might have spotted the two men, the horses, the mule, and the buckboard, but they were racing hell-bent for leather toward Abilene and didn't appear to even glance toward the trees. By the time they went past, the kid had pulled a pair of field glasses from his saddlebags and was watching them. He recognized three of them from the previous evening in Marshal Fisher's office. The long-haired youngster, the derby-wearing old-timer, and a pale-faced gunny with jet-black hair, the one member of the group who hadn't said anything the night before. The only one missing was the hombre with the big nose and the drooping mustache. Fisher had told the kid that his name was Jim Mundy, and that Mundy had a reputation of sorts as a gunslinger and killer. The old coot was Riggs, the flat-eyed youngster Chet, and the pale gunman Stevenson. The kid lowered the glasses. He could think of only one reason why some of Court Elam's men would be on their way to Abilene in such a hurry. They had heard about the soiled dove dying and knew the sheriff was on his way to pick up Barnes and take him back to the lockup in the county seat. It looked like some of Elam's men weren't prepared to abandon Barnes to that fate, no matter what their boss said. Mundy hadn't come along, but his place had been taken by three more gun wolves.
You look troubled, kid.
Those were some of the men who shot up the marshal's office last night. I think they're on their way to Abilene to bust their friend out of jail.
It's not your responsibility to prevent that.
I know. My kids could be less than 30 miles away right this very minute. But Fisher's a good man, and he tried to help us.
Only after you helped him?
That wouldn't have made any difference.
The kid reached a decision.
I'm going back. It's not that far to town. You can wait for me here. There's some shade, and I shouldn't be gone that long.
Unless you're fatally injured, of course.
In that case, don't wait.
Kid, perhaps I should come along.
You're good at a lot of things, Arturo, but this is my kind of work.
With that, he heeled the black into a run and took off after the hard cases who were pounding toward Abilene. By the time the kid came in sight of the town, he heard the faint popping of gunfire. Elam's men hadn't wasted any time, he thought grimly. They had just ridden in and started shooting. He figured Marshal Fisher had to be alive since the battle was still going on. If the lawman had been able to fort up in the sturdy stone building that housed his office and the jail, he would be able to hold off Elam's hired killers for a while. As long as the shooting went on, the innocent citizens of Abilene would also be in danger. The kid knew better than to go charging in without scouting out the situation first. Being careless was a quick way of getting killed. He pulled his Winchester from the saddle boot and reined the black to a stop on the edge of town. Dropping to the ground, the kid ran around one of the buildings and started up the alley that ran behind the businesses. He could tell from the steady blasting of guns when he was getting close to the ruckus. He moved up the side of a hardware store until he reached the front corner of the building. Venturing a glance into the street, he saw that he was diagonally across from the marshal's office. The kid looked to the right and saw four men firing at the office. One of them was stretched out behind a water trough. Stevenson crouched behind a barrel on the porch of the general store, and the old-timer Riggs and another man had taken cover behind a wagon parked in front of the store. The kid didn't see the long-haired youngster Chet or the other man who had been in the group riding toward Abilene. The whereabouts of Chet and the other man worried the kid. He had a hunch they were up to no good somewhere close by. Return fire came from one of the windows in the marshal's office. The shutters were closed except for a narrow gap that allowed Fisher to thrust the barrel of his rifle through it. Eventually, Riggs and the others might do enough damage to the shutters with their heavy, continuous fire that the shutters wouldn't stop their bullets anymore. Likewise, Fisher might be able to pick off attackers even though they were behind cover if he had long enough to work at it. For the moment, it was a standoff. The kid was glad to see that the boardwalks along both sides of the street were deserted. The citizens had scrambled to get out of sight as soon as the shooting started. Maybe no innocent bystanders would be hurt. None of the gunmen had spotted the kid. He was going to take them by surprise, he thought, as he lifted his Winchester. He could down a couple before they realized what was going on, and then he would take his chances with the other two. But before he could fire, he spotted movement on top of the jail. The building had a flat roof with a low stone wall around it. The kid saw the heads of two men moving around behind that wall. Chet and the other man rose up on their knees. He recognized the long-haired killer without any trouble. They were fumbling with something between them, and as sparks suddenly flew, the kid figured out Chet had lit the fuse attached to a small bundle of dynamite being held by the other man. The hard case put a hand on top of the wall and leaned out. He was going to drop the dynamite right in front of the window where Fisher was shooting at the men across the street. Without thinking, the kid snapped the rifle to his shoulder and fired. The slug smashed through the shoulder of the man with the dynamite and threw him backward. The red, paper-wrapped cylinders of explosive flew high in the air as they slipped from his fingers, then dropped back toward the roof. Chet leaped off the top of the building. He might break a leg in the fall, but at least he wouldn't get blown to smithereens.
Fisher, get out of there!
The kid swung the rifle toward the other killers and worked the lever. Riggs and the other man behind the wagon swung about and opened fire on him. The kid ducked around the corner as flames spurted from their gun muzzles and bullets began to whip past his head. Across the street, Chet scrambled to his feet and ran away from the marshal's office, limping heavily. Obviously, he hadn't broken his leg when he landed. He hadn't made it very far when the dynamite exploded on top of the building. The blast was powerful enough to shake the ground under the kid's boots. The force of it sprayed chunks of rock through the air and picked Chet up, tossing him forward like a rag doll. Debris carried far enough to pelt the buildings across the street, forcing Riggs and his pals to stop shooting for the moment and duck for cover. A cloud of dust and smoke billowed up, obscuring the kid's view of the marshal's office. He was sure he hadn't seen Fisher come out of there before the blast. The kid recovered his wits and stepped out of the alley with the rifle ready in his hands. Stevenson, who still knelt behind the barrel on the porch, jerked his rifle toward him. The kid's Winchester cracked first. the slug drilling into Stevenson's chest. The kid shifted his aim toward the wagon. Riggs had fallen down, but the other man was still on his feet. The kid pulled the trigger. The man doubled over as the bullet slammed into his belly and tore through his gut. The next instant, the kid's Winchester was ripped out of his hands as a bullet from the man on the ground behind the water trough smashed into the breech. Pain shot up the kid's arms as his hands went numb. He dove to the ground at the mouth of the alley. Another bullet went over his head, then another. Riggs had climbed to his knees and was back in the fight with a revolver he had yanked from the holster on his hip. The kid tried to force his stunned nerves and muscles to work, but he couldn't draw his Colt. It would only be a matter of seconds before Riggs and the other man filled him full of lead. Marshal Fisher came out of the cloud of smoke and dust that still clogged the street. He was hatless and blood streaked his face, but he was alive and had a revolver in his hand.
Hey!
Riggs and the other killer turned toward him. Riggs stumbled and clutched at his chest. Crimson welled between his fingers. He fell to his knees, then pitched forward onto his face. The other man's head jerked as one of Fisher's slugs exploded through it. He dropped his gun and rolled onto his side as he died. Fisher didn't seem to be hurt any worse than he already was when he emerged from the smoke. Slowly, he lowered his gun. Enough feeling had returned to the kid's right arm and hand that he was able to reach down and draw his Colt. He pointed it in Fisher's direction and pulled the trigger. The slug thudded into flesh behind the marshal, and he turned his head in time to see Chet collapse, with a bright flower of blood blooming on the chest of his shirt. Fisher looked at the kid and nodded.
Obliged.
Same here.
That was all either man needed to say. The kid climbed wearily to his feet. He grimaced as he looked down at his Winchester lying in the dirt and saw that the rifle was ruined. He'd buy another one, of course, before he rejoined Arturo and proceeded on to Powderhorn. But the battle with Elam's men might have complicated the whole thing, he thought. The kid walked over to Fisher.
How bad are you hurt?
Not enough to worry about. A few nicks and bruises, that's all. I was damned lucky. I got blown out on top of the front wall.
The kid looked at the marshal's office. The smoke had cleared enough for him to see some of the damage the explosion had done to the building. Most of the front wall had collapsed, and so had some of the roof. The other walls were still standing.
What about your prisoner?
I don't know. Reckon I'd better go see, soon as we make sure all the rest of these varmints are dead.
That didn't take long. None of the men had survived. The kid figured there wouldn't be enough left of the man who'd been on the roof when the dynamite went off to bury. Guns in hand, the two men approached the ruined jail. They picked their way through the rubble of rocks and splintered roof beams until they reached the cell block. The roof had come down on top of the cell where the prisoner was being held. The kid could see an arm and a leg sticking out from under the rubble, along with a rapidly spreading pool of blood around the remains.
Well, his friend saved him from the hang rope, anyway.
Now that the shooting was over, the people of Abilene began to emerge from their hiding places. A large group of them gathered in the street to gape at the destruction the dynamite had wreaked on the marshal's office and jail. A wagon pulled up, and a black-suited man, the Undertaker, climbed down.
Some of you fellows help me load these bodies.
The Undertaker and some volunteers began lifting the dead gunman into the back of the wagon. The kid and Marshal Fisher climbed out of the rubble. The kid nodded toward the gash on the lawman's forehead.
You'd better have a doctor stitch that up.
Fisher dabbed at the sticky blood with his fingertips.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Come along with me?
Sure.
The two of them walked along the street. The air still smelled of dust and gun smoke.
What made you come back? I thought you were on your way to Powderhorn with your friend.
I was. We spotted those riders coming, and my gut told me to get off the trail. When they rode past, I recognized some of the men who were here last night. Figured they were bound for trouble and thought you might be able to use a little help.
That's for damn sure. I didn't see Jim Mundy among them.
He didn't come along. I thought you figured Elam wouldn't try to get his man free now that the charge was murder.
Mundy not being here proves that. Riggs and Chet were a pair of hotheads. A lot alike, even though they were probably 40 years between them. Elam likely said to let it alone, but they couldn't swallow that. Barnes was their friend. So they decided to bust Barnes out anyway and talk some more of Elam's men into coming with them.
That was a mistake on their part.
The last one they'll make.
They had reached the trim little house where the local doctor's practice was located. The medico was young but seemed quite competent. He cleaned and sewed up the gash on the marshal's forehead, then wrapped a bandage around Fisher's head. The kid turned to Fisher as they left the doctor's office.
What'll you do for a jail now?
Don't worry. I'll find some place to lock up prisoners if I need to. There are some pretty sturdy smokehouses around here. I'll salvage what I can from the office and move into the town hall till we can fix the place.
Rebuild it, you mean? I think Chet and the other man on the roof underestimated the amount of damage that dynamite was going to do. They were going to drop it right down in front of the window where you were returning the fire of the others, blow a hole in the front wall.
Yeah, that would have blown me up too. How come it went off on top of the building instead?
I shot the man holding it and knocked him backward. Dynamite flew up in the air and came back down on the roof. Since the fuse was already burning...
Well, I'm even more obliged to you than I knew. You sure you don't want me to go to Powderhorn with you?
I'm sure. You'll have your hands full here, cleaning all this up and getting a new marshal's office and jail built. You'll have to explain to the sheriff when he gets here that he rode all the way from county seat for nothing. Justice has already been done.
He won't be happy about that. If you ever come through these parts again, stop by and say hello. Maybe all hell won't break loose again.
Maybe not.
But somehow, the kid doubted it. Arturo was still waiting in the clump of cottonwoods where the kid had left him. When he rode up a short time later, Arturo put the rifle he'd been holding across his lap in the back of the buckboard.
I noticed what looked like quite a bit of smoke rising in the direction of Abilene a while ago. I suppose you were responsible for that, kid?
Well, sort of. But mainly it was the fault of the fellow with the dynamite.
Dynamite?
Yeah, the one who blew up the jail.
Ah, I see. Is Marshal Fisher all right?
Yeah, I got there in time to give him a hand. Those men of Elam's won't bother him anymore. Unfortunately, he no longer has a prisoner to turn over to the sheriff. The explosion sort of took care of that problem, too.
Well, that simplifies matters for the Marshal, I suppose. I take it that we'll be continuing on to Powderhorn as planned.
That's right. Are you ready to go?
Of course.
But Arturo didn't put the team into motion right away.
I was quite glad to see you ride up, sir. I would have gone on without you, but I was hoping that wouldn't be necessary.
You'd have tried to find my kids on your own?
Certainly. They're the children of Conrad Browning. They need to know that. They need to receive the legacy that would be coming to them.
I'm obliged to you for that, amigo.
When evening came, the kid led the way about half a mile off the road before he found a good place to camp. He wasn't expecting trouble, but it never hurt to be careful about picking a place to spend the night. In the morning, they pushed on toward Powderhorn. They encountered several cowboys on horseback and a farming family in a rundown wagon. None of these pilgrims had represented any threat. Around mid-morning, the kid spotted travelers up ahead on the road, heading east toward Abilene. He reined in and motioned for Arturo to stop as well. Something about the riders coming toward them struck the kid as different. For one thing, there were half a dozen men on horses accompanying a black buggy. As the distance narrowed, the kid saw that only one man sat in the buggy, handling the reins.
Let's get out of their way, Arturo. Is that rifle of yours still handy?
I'll get it out of the back and put it on the floorboard.
Put it on the seat beside you where it's handy. Go ahead and lever around into the chamber.
Arturo looked worried, but readied his rifle. The kid moved his black saddle horse and the pack mule aside from the trail as well, tying the mule's reins to the back of the buckboard. Then he slid his Winchester from its sheath and laid it across the saddle in front of him. By that time, the travelers were close enough the kid recognized the hawk-like nose and drooping mustache of Jim Mundy, the gunman who, according to Marshal Fisher, was Court Elam's segundo. More than likely, that made Elam the man in the buggy, the kid thought. The rest of the riders were typical hard cases, like the other members of Elam's gun crew. The kid could make a guess why Elam and some of his men were on their way to Abilene. As the group neared the spot where the kid and Arturo waited, Mundy scowled in recognition. He moved his horse closer to the buggy and said something to the driver. It came as no surprise to the kid when the man hauled back on the reins and brought the vehicle to a halt. The riders reined in and arranged their horses, three on each side of the buggy. The man in the buggy regarded the kid with a cool stare. He was in his 40s, the kid judged, but already had iron gray hair under his expensive brown Stetson. His brown tweed suit had cost plenty, as had the diamond stick pin in his cravat. He was lean in face and body, with watchful, deep-set eyes.
You're the man called Morgan.
That's right. And you'd be Court Elam.
You've heard of me, I see.
Heard plenty. None of it good.
Mundy's scowl darkened as he leaned forward slightly in his saddle. His hand moved an inch or so toward the butt of his gun. Elam lifted a hand and motioned for Mundy to take it easy. It was a casual gesture, as if Elam knew it would be obeyed instantly and without hesitation.
We're not looking for any trouble, Mr. Morgan. We're on a side errand this morning. Some of my employees met an untimely end yesterday, as you well know. I'm on my way to Abilene to make the final arrangements for them.
Fitting, since you sent them there to die.
Just because a man's employees do something doesn't mean that he ordered them to do it. Sometimes they do exactly the opposite of what he might wish.
Are you saying they came to Abilene on their own?
That's right. Sometimes men will get carried away when a friend of theirs is in trouble and do something unwise.
How'd you find out what happened?
Well, I'm not sure that it's any of your business. But Marshal Fisher notified me of the tragedy.
Fisher might do that, the kid thought. Fisher might send a telegram to Elam in Powderhorn, telling him to come get the bodies of his hired guns. But Fisher probably wouldn't have gone into detail about the kid's part in the events of the previous day. He suspected Elam had spies in Abilene, or at least friends who could have given him the whole story.
You and your friend appear to be bound for Powderhorn, Mr. Morgan. Is that the case?
It might be.
If you're there for any amount of time, we'll probably run into each other again. I own a number of businesses in the settlement.
Maybe so.
Right now, though, we have to get on to Abilene. We have an unpleasant chore awaiting us. So long.
Elam flicked the reins against the back of the buggy horse. The kid didn't say anything as Elam got the vehicle moving again. He sat there stoically as the gunman rode past, sending hostile looks his way. The Winchester stayed where it was on the saddle in front of him as the group from Powderhorn moved on.
I was convinced they were going to kill us.
They thought about trying, and Elam knew he'd be the first one to die if they did.
I'll never become accustomed to this, you know.
You'd be surprised what a man can get used to when he doesn't have any other choice.
Arturo didn't argue the point as they continued on their way to Powderhorn. They didn't stop for lunch, since the kid thought they were getting pretty close to the settlement. It was only a little after 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the kid spotted a church steeple up ahead, along with the roofs of several buildings and a smudge of green indicating the presence of trees, planted, watered, and cared for by humans, since the Kansas prairie was largely treeless. As they drew closer, the kid looked for a building big enough to be used as an orphanage, figuring such an institution would be located on the outskirts of town. He didn't see one. The railroad tracks curved toward the settlement. A red brick depot building stood at the southern end of the main street, which ran due north for half a dozen blocks to a wooden bridge that spanned a creek. The stream's meandering path formed Powderhorn's northern boundary. The kid had no idea how the town had gotten its name. He didn't see any physical features that reminded him of a Powderhorn. The trail turned into a road that ran along the front of the depot. Main Street dead-ended into it on the kid's right as he and Arturo approached the station. Even before they turned onto Main Street, the kid saw a warehouse on the far corner. A sign with Elam Freight Company painted on it hung on the front of the building. On the other side of the warehouse was a large barn and corral. The sign on it read, Elam Freight Lines. The kid supposed Elam had merchandise shipped in by train, stored it in the warehouse belonging to Elam Freight Company, and delivered it in the wagons belonging to the Elam Freight Lines to settlements that weren't on the railroad line. That was a handy arrangement. It didn't end there, however. The kid and Arturo also passed Elam's Livery Stable, Elam's General Mercantile Store, and Elam's Prairie Bell Saloon. Across the street stood the Elam Hotel. The kid was getting good and sick of that name.
Mr. Elam certainly wasn't exaggerating, was he? How do you Americans put it? He appears to own half the town.
At least.
He saw a building on the left with the words Marshal's Office on a sign that hung from the wooden awning over the boardwalk. Deciding to start his search there, he angled toward the hitch rail in front of the lawman's office, and Arturo followed. The kid swung down from the saddle and looped the black's reins around the rail.
You might as well stay here until I find out something. No need for you to climb up and down if you don't have to.
Very well.
Arturo took off his hat and pulled a handkerchief from his pocket to pat beads of sweat off his forehead while the kid went to the door of the marshal's office. The door was locked, he discovered when he tried the knob. and no one responded to his knocks on it. A stocky man ambling along the boardwalk stopped to watch him for a moment.
You looking for the marshal, mister?
That's right. Do you know where he is?
Sure I do.
Can you tell me where to find him?
Yep. You see the church up the end of town on the other side of the street?
I see it.
Go on around back and you'll find the cemetery. That's where the marshal is. Just look for the tombstone that has "Here Lies a Damn Fool" carved on it.
The townsman appeared to be completely serious. He was short and thick and had a close-cropped gray beard. His clothes were stained and had a definite odor of manure about them, which told the kid the man probably worked in the livery stable.
You mean the marshal is dead?
That's right.
What happened to him? And I don't mean the business about him being a damn fool.
He took his job too serious-like. Tried to keep the peace one night when he should have just let it go. He knew good and well the law only gets enforced a certain way around here, or at least it should have.
And Court Elam decides what way that is. Who killed the marshal? Jim Mundy or another of Elam's gun wolves?
Mister, I don't know you, and I've said all I'm gonna say, probably more than I should have.
The kid noticed that Powderhorn didn't appear to be a very busy place. Only a few people were on the boardwalks, and just a handful of horses were tied up at the hitch rails.
Is everybody taking a siesta? Or do Elam and his men have folks so scared they won't come out of their homes and businesses unless they have to?
Like I told you, I ain't saying anything else. I gotta get back to work.
At the Elam livery stable?
A man's gotta eat, and so does the rest of his family. You can work for somebody without agreeing with everything he does. If it wasn't you holding down that job, it'd be somebody else.
That's a convenient way to think.
Look, you ain't from around here, mister. You don't know how it is.
You can answer one more question for me.
I told you.
Where can I find Mrs. Shanley's orphanage?
The man looked surprised by the question. His eyes widened for a second, then narrowed in suspicion.
Why do you want to know? You and your friend in the buggy there don't look like orphans to me.
As a matter of fact, both of my parents are deceased. But it happened a long time ago, so I don't really think of myself as an orphan.
And my father's still alive.
I don't really care. I don't mix in things that don't concern me, and that Shanley woman and her blamed orphans are one of them.
With a hostile glare, he walked off down the street toward the stable.
Well, he was certainly an unhelpful fellow.
Not completely. He told us more about how things are around here. Not very good, from the sound of it. Elam and his men have this town treed.
And by that you mean everyone is afraid of them?
Yeah. I'm curious why he didn't want to say anything about the orphanage. That doesn't seem like something that would get anybody in trouble.
He untied the black's reins, but didn't mount up, leading the gelding up the street. Arturo brought the buckboard alongside him.
Where are we going, kid?
To see somebody who maybe won't mind telling us about the orphanage.
The kid angled across the street toward the church. It was a whitewashed frame building with a square bell tower that had a tall wooden steeple on top. As he looked along the side of the building, he saw the fenced graveyard behind it. A few small cottonwood trees provided shade where the citizens of Powderhorn who had passed on had been laid to rest. The kid tied the black's reins to the buckboard.
Shall I come with you, sir?
That'll be fine.
They stepped into the church and walked through a small foyer into the sanctuary. It was cooler inside, out of the sun.
Hello?
Up here.
The kid turned and looked into the foyer where a narrow door stood open a few inches. He opened it more and saw a ladder propped up inside the tiny room. Light spilled through an open trapdoor at the top of the ladder. It led up into the bell tower.
Wait there, I'll be right down.
A moment later, a man's shape blocked off the light coming through the trap door. He started climbing down the ladder.
I was working on the bell, on the rope, actually. It was getting rather frayed. Wouldn't do to have it snap some Sunday morning while I'm ringing the bell to summon the faithful to services.
No, I suppose not. Are you the pastor here?
Oh, that's right.
He was young, no more than 25, with a friendly, slightly rounded face and brown hair. He wore a pair of corduroy trousers and a work shirt with the sleeves rolled up over his forearms.
Thomas Kellogg.
Pleased to meet you, Reverend.
Oh, please, no Reverend. Just Thomas Fine, or Brother Tom, if you insist. I saw you gentlemen ride into town. There's a good view from up there, you know. In a land as flat as this, you can see a long way from any sort of elevation.
I'm sure you can. We were hoping you could tell us where to find a lady named Shanley.
Mrs. Shanley? Who runs the orphanage? Why do you want to know?
I need to ask her about something.
And who are you, exactly?
The kid kept a tight rein on his impatience.
They call me Kid Morgan.
Not the Kid Morgan. The one in the dime novels? Oh, I know a preacher's not really supposed to read such things, but they're so exciting. From time to time, they teach good moral lessons. I mean, good always triumphs over evil in the end, doesn't it?
In dime novels, maybe.
Well, it's really an honor to meet you. But I'd still like to know what your business with Miss Teresa, I mean, Miss Shanley.
I'm looking for some children.
She has quite a few, although I'm not sure that a man such as yourself, I mean, a man with no permanent place of residence.
You mean a drifting gunfighter is not really the sort of man you think would want to adopt an orphan?
Well, no offense intended, but yes, that thought did cross my mind.
I'm not planning to adopt. I'm looking for two children, a boy and a girl. Twins, between 3 and 4 years old.
Again, in all good conscience, I have to pry into something that may not be any of my business.
It's not, but I'll tell you anyway. I don't have to adopt those children. They're already mine. I'm their father.
For a long moment, Kellogg didn't say anything.
Well, where is the mother?
Dead. Do you know if Miss Shanley has them?
I've only been the pastor here for a year and a half, Mr. Morgan. Before that, I was in Springfield, Missouri. There are several children of that age in Mrs. Shanley's care, but I don't know how they came to be with her, or if any of them are brother and sister. I can tell you that I never noticed any twins among them.
Fraternal twins don't always look that much alike.
Oh, so they're fraternal twins.
I don't know.
You expect me to believe these children belong to you, and you don't even know if they're identical twins?
It's a long story. Are you going to tell me where to find the orphanage or not?
You know, when I first saw the two of you come into town, I thought maybe you were some of Mr. Ellum's men.
Do I look like a hired gunman to you, sir?
I'll admit, you don't. And who are you?
I work for the kid here. I am his Batman.
A gunfighter's got a valet?
Another long story. Please, Reverend, I mean Brother Tom, the children I'm looking for may not be with Mrs. Shanley, but I have to be sure. Just tell me where to find her place, if you will.
I'll do better than that. I'll take you there.
I'd be obliged for your help.
If I can help reunite a father with some lost children, well, that's just one more way of doing the Lord's work, as I see it.
Nobody's going to argue with you there.
It's an easy walk, up here and around the corner on 5th Street.
The houses of Powderhorn's citizens were on the cross streets. Kellogg took them to one that rose 3 stories, with a gabled roof and trees growing around it. It would have been a stern, forbidding place without the flower beds in front of it and the bright curtains in the windows. On his way into town, the kid had been looking for some ugly, institutional-appearing building, probably of stone or brick. He wouldn't have picked out that place as an orphanage. It looked more like the private home of a well-to-do businessman.
Mrs. Shanley and her husband were some of the original settlers in Powderhorn. They had something to do with the railroad, and he also established a very successful store here. But then a fever came through the area, and he caught it and passed away. So did the Shanley's children. Since Mrs. Shanley was left alone, she took in the children of all the families where both parents had died of the fever. That's how the orphanage got started. At least, that's the way I've heard the story. I didn't live here then, you know. But I have no reason to doubt that it's true.
Neither did the kid. He felt his heart pounding harder as the three of them went up the walk to the front porch. His son and daughter could be in there, only a few yards away from him.
I'm surprised the kids aren't out playing.
Well, the younger ones are napping. The older ones are studying. Teresa insists on a good education.
Kellogg knocked on the door frame. A moment passed, and then the door swung open. The fact that Kellogg had a habit of referring to Mrs. Shanley by her given name should have warned him, the kid thought, and so should have the preacher's comment about her own children dying of the fever. But in his anxiousness to find out if his kids were there, he hadn't considered those things, and so he was surprised to see that the woman standing in the doorway with a smile on her face was a beautiful blonde who couldn't be any more than 30 years old.
Hello, Tom. What brings you here?
She looked past him at the kid and Arturo.
And who are your friends?
This is Mr. Morgan and his helper. I'm afraid I didn't catch your name.
Arturo swept his hat off and stepped forward to take hold of Teresa Shanley's hand.
Arturo Vincenzo, madame.
He pressed his lips to the back of her hand.
At your service.
Teresa looked a little surprised, as anybody would have under the circumstances.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Vincenzo, was it?
The kid took his hat off and suppressed the impulse to toss Arturo aside. The kid moved forward.
Ma'am, we're looking for a couple of children who may have been left here in your care a few years ago.
What's your relation to these children, Mr. Morgan?
They're my son and daughter.
I only have children here who have been orphaned.
That's just it. The woman who brought them here would have told you some sort of story to explain why she had to leave them with you. She probably told you that their parents were dead.
Why would she have done a thing like that?
Well, it's probably a long story.
It is.
Well, so why don't we go inside?
Of course. Where are my manners? Come in, please.
She stepped back and ushered them into the house. They went into a comfortably furnished parlor.
Would you like some coffee or lemonade?
A lemonade would be nice. I've been replacing that worn-out bell rope in the steeple this afternoon. It was thirsty work.
Sit down, gentlemen. I'll be right back.
Though he was trying hard not to show it, the kid's emotions were running wild inside him. After all the danger and worry, he might be on the verge of reclaiming his children. Or rather, claiming them for the first time, he told himself, because he had never seen them before. It was a thrilling moment and a frightening one, all at the same time. He and Arturo sat down in armchairs while Kellogg took a seat on a sofa.
Something just occurred to me, Mr. Morgan. If the children are here, how are you going to prove that they're yours?
What do you mean?
Well, do you have any sort of records, any documents that prove you're the children's father?
The kid's heart slugged in his chest. He had never thought about that. He had been so consumed with finding the twins, with the search itself, the idea of proof hadn't entered his mind. He couldn't come up with any words to say.
We have a letter from the mother of the children. It explains why she set out to conceal from Mr. Morgan not just the location of the children, but also their very existence.
Kellogg held up a hand to stop him.
Well, you might as well wait until Teresa gets back. Then you'll only have to go through the story once.
That's a good idea.
Teresa returned a few minutes later with a tray and glasses of lemonade.
Mr. Morgan is going to explain the situation.
I'm eager to hear that explanation.
Several years ago, I was engaged to a woman named Pamela Tarleton. Our engagement ended before we were married. What I didn't know at the time was that she was already with child. Sorry, Reverend. I mean, Brother Tom.
I'm not here to judge, Mr. Morgan, just to listen.
Well, I found out recently that Pamela, Miss Tarleton, gave birth to a son and daughter, twins.
You never knew about this?
Not until a few weeks ago. I got a letter that she had left behind with a relative. She was upset with me, blamed me not only for ending our engagement, but for the death of her father as well.
Did you have anything to do with that?
No, ma'am, I did not. But that didn't stop Pamela from being angry with me. She deliberately withheld the news of the twins' birth from me, and she informed me in the letter that she had hidden them away where I would never find them.
Oh, that's terrible.
What did you do when you found out about this, Mr. Morgan?
Naturally, I set out to find the children. I tracked Pamela, the children, and a servant to a train bound for San Francisco. It seems like she might have stopped somewhere along the way and left the children in a place she thought they wouldn't be found. So Arturo and I are having a look around in every likely settlement we come to.
So when you heard there was an orphanage in Powderhorn...
What better place to hide a couple kids?
I take it that Miss Tarleton has dropped out of sight, too, so you can't just ask her? I would think a court might compel her to talk.
She's dead.
I see. Mr. Morgan, you have my sympathy. I'm sure it was quite a shock for you to find out that you're a father, and I can understand why you want to locate your children, but I'm afraid I can't help you.
Are you sure you don't remember? It would have been about 3 years ago.
There are no twins here. I'm certain. You see, I keep good records. I know where each of the children living here came from, and I can assure you, no woman got off the train and dropped off a couple of infants.
The kid felt a surge of anger and frustration. He had convinced himself that he might be close to the end of his quest.
No offense, Mrs. Shanley, but would you mind if I took a look at the children? I'd like to see for myself.
What would you like to see, Mr. Morgan? That none of them are the right age or bear a resemblance to you or your late fiancé? Why would I lie to you about such a thing?
Pamela Tarleton had a lot of money. In tracking her movements, we've run into several people that she paid off to do what she wanted.
I'm not one of them, and I resent the implication that I am.
Like I said, I meant no offense, but I don't know you, ma'am. Taking care of a bunch of kids can't be easy, and it probably costs quite a bit, too.
I do know Mrs. Shanley, Mr. Morgan, and I can promise you she's a truthful woman.
Thanks, Tom, but I can defend myself. My husband left me fairly comfortable as far as money is concerned, and the members of Tom's church have been very generous with both time and money to help me out. There haven't been any problems until...
Until when? Until Pamela showed up?
I told you I never met the woman. And any problems I may have are none of your business. No offense meant.
I'd still like
to see... This visit is over. Good day, sir. Tom, would you please show Mr. Morgan and Mr. Vincenzo out?
Kellogg looked uncomfortable. In his profession, he was used to being a peacemaker, and he had unwittingly brought conflict into that house. But clearly, he was on Teresa's side in the dispute.
Gentlemen, please.
I'm sorry, ma'am. It wasn't my intention to cause trouble. I just want to find my children.
I understand that, but they're not here.